Hitler switched his panzers to Operation Typhoon, the grand offensive against Moscow, designed to deliver the knockout blow to Soviet Russia. Guderian's panzers surprised and then outflanked the Bryansk front, just as, back in Moscow, Stalin welcomed Lord Beaverbrook, the puckish Canadian press baron and member of the British War Cabinet, and Avril Harriman, the American envoy, who had come to negotiate military aid to keep Russia in the war. At dinner, Stalin drank continuously from a small glass, wrote Beaverbrook, who recorded everything with the avidity of one of his Daily Express columnists. He ate well and even heartily, nibbling caviar off his knife without bread and butter. Stalin and Beaverbrook, two mercurial rogues, jousted mischievously. Pointing at President Kalinin, Beaverbrook, who had heard about his taste for ballerinas, asked if the old man had a mistress. "He's too old," chuckled Stalin. "Do you?" As the Westerners departed, the Germans broke through towards Moscow. On the 3rd of October, Guderian took Oryol, 125 miles behind the supposed Russian front line. 665,000 Russians were surrounded. On the 4th, Stalin lost contact with the shattered West Front under Konev, leaving a 12-mile hole in Moscow's defences. Early on the 5th, the Moscow air commander, Zbitov, reported the almost incredible news that a long column of German tanks was heading for Moscow along the Okhnovo Highway, 60 miles from the Kremlin. "Very well," Stalin told the Moscow commissar Telyagin. "Act decisively and energetically. Mobilize every available resource to hold the enemy." Stalin's entourage tried to crush this news as they had tried to deny the German invasion. "Look," Beria threatened Telyagin, "do you take every bit of nonsense as the truth? You've evidently received information from panic-mongers and provocateurs." Stalin phoned Zhukov in Leningrad. "I've only got one request. Can you get on a plane and come to Moscow?" "I'll be there." As Zhukov arrived at the Kremlin flat, Stalin was talking to Beria. "Probably unaware of my arrival," in Zhukov's words, Stalin was ordering Beria to sound out the possibilities of making a separate peace with Germany given the critical situation. Stalin was probing German resolve, but there was no moment when Hitler was less likely to make peace than when Moscow seemed to be falling. Without a wisp of small talk, Stalin ordered Zhukov to fly to the Western Front. Heading into the whirlwind, Zhukov found the dazed commanders, the tough, shaven-headed Konev and the commissar Bulganin, in a desolate room barely lit by candles. Bulganin had just spoken to Stalin, but could not tell him anything because we ourselves don't know. When Zhukov called Stalin, he reported, "The main danger now is that the roads into Moscow are virtually undefended." "And the reserves?" Stalin asked. "Encircled." Stalin dispatched Molotov and Malenkov into this cauldron to take control and assign blame. Such was the havoc that Zhukov could not find Marshal Budioni. Eventually he found a small town completely deserted except for a chauffeur asleep in a jeep who turned out to be Budioni's driver. The marshal was inside the district Soviet, trying to find his own armies on his map. The two cavalrymen embraced warmly. Budioni had saved Zhukov from arrest during the terror, but now he was confused and exhausted. The next morning, Stalin ordered Zhukov to return to the Western Front headquarters and take command. There, Zhukov found Molotov, Malenkov, Voroshilov and Bulganin indulging in an ugly hunt for a scapegoat. A stand-up row broke out between Konev and Voroshilov about who had ordered what withdrawal. Konev's life hung in the balance when Voroshilov shrieked that he was a traitor. Stalin phoned to order Konev's arrest, but Zhukov persuaded the Supremo that he needed Konev as his deputy. "If Moscow falls," Stalin threatened, "both your heads'll roll. Organize the Western Front quickly and act." 2 days later, Molotov telephoned and threatened to shoot Zhukov if he did not stop the retreat. "If Molotov could do any better," retorted Zhukov, "he was welcome to try." Molotov hung up. Zhukov stiffened the resistance, though he possessed only 90,000 men to defend Moscow. He fought for time, with the fray reaching unprecedented frenzies of savagery. By the 18th, The city of Kalinin had fallen to the north, and Kaluga to the south, and there were panzers on the battlefields of Borodino. Snow fell, then thawed, stirring up a boggy quagmire which temporarily halted the Germans. Both sides fought heroically, tank helm to tank helm, like two giants wrestling in a sea of mud. On the streets of Moscow, the chains of Stalinist control were snapped by fear of the German armies. Law broke down. By the 14th of October, food shops were being looted, empty apartments burgled, refugees clogged the streets, harassed by gangs of desperados. The smoke of bonfires hung over the city as officials burned papers. At Kursk station, a crush of women, children, and old people filled the square. The cold was piercing. Children were weeping. But the masses waited patiently and submissively. 100 soldiers joined arms to hold back the mob. AA guns illuminated the sky, while the half-deserted Kremlin was blacked out and weirdly camouflaged. A huge canvas, painted with the facades of houses, had been hoisted up over the walls facing the river. Beria, Malenkov, and Kaganovich lost their self-control, encouraging flight. "We shall be shot down like partridges," Beria told one meeting, advocating the swift abandonment of Moscow. On the night of the 15th of October, Beria made things worse, calling a meeting of the local party leaders and announcing, "The connection with the front is broken." He ordered them to evacuate everyone who's unable to defend Moscow, distribute food to the inhabitants. Molotov told ambassadors that they would be immediately evacuated. Stalin himself presented an air of solitary inscrutability, revealing his plans to no one, while the magnates prepared for evacuation. As the air raids on Moscow intensified, Stalin climbed up onto the sunroof at Kuntsevo and watched the dogfights. Once, some shrapnel fell near him, and Vlasik handed him the warm fragments. When Vasily Stalin arrived one night to visit his father, a German plane passed over the house. The guards did not open fire since they did not want to draw attention to Stalin's residence. "Cowards!" shouted Vasily, firing the guns himself. Stalin came out. "Did he hit anything?" he asked. "No, he didn't." "Winner of the Voroshilov Marksman Prize," he said dryly. But the stress was telling on him. No one could believe how much he had aged. Stalin's staff prepared for his departure without actually checking with him. The dachas were dynamited. A special train was prepared, standing in a hidden siding, packed with belongings such as his beloved library. 4 American Douglas DC-3 aeroplanes stood ready. On the 15th of October, Stalin ordered his guards to drive him out to Kuntsevo, which had been closed down and mined. The commandant told him he could not go in, but Stalin ordered, "Clear the mines, stoke the stove in the little house, and I'll work there." The next morning, he headed into the Kremlin earlier than usual. On the way, this worshipper of order was amazed to see mobs looting shops. He ordered the car to stop on Smolensk Square, where he was surrounded by a crowd who asked rather pertinent questions such as, "When will the Soviet army stop the enemy?" "That day's near," he replied, before driving on to the Kremlin. At 9 a.m., the magnates gathered in Stalin's flat to debate the great decision. Stalin proposed to evacuate the whole government to Kuibyshev, to order the army to defend the capital and keep the Germans fighting until he could throw in his reserves. He proposed that all the Politburo leave that day, and, he added sensationally, "I will leave tomorrow morning." "Why do we have to leave today if you're leaving tomorrow?" Mikoyan indignantly asked. "I'm staying, and I'll go tomorrow with you." Stalin agreed. As the leaders rushed in and out of Stalin's office, their families were given just an hour's notice to evacuate the city. Zhukov resolved to hold the line. But he could sense the panic at the top. He was convinced he could save Moscow, he told a visiting editor. "But are they there?" he asked, meaning Stalin in the Kremlin. That evening, the leaders arrived in an eerily deserted Kremlin. "What's the situation?" asked Stalin. The magnates remained silent, but a junior commissar spoke up. "The metro was not running. The bakeries were closed. The factories thought the government had fled. Half of them had not been paid. Workers believed the boss of the state bank had run off with the money. Well, it's not so bad. I thought it would be worse. Stalin ordered money to be flown in. Shcherbakov and Pronin, Moscow's party chief and mayor, must restore order and broadcast the fact that Moscow would be held to the last drop of blood. Stalin remained in the Kremlin. The leaders headed out into the town. Mikoyan appeared before 5,000 restless, unpaid workers at the Stalin automobile works. But the panic continued. Stragglers and thieves patrolled the streets. Even the British embassy, across the Moskva from the Kremlin, was looted, its guards having fled. Demolition units mined Moscow's 16 bridges. Stalin hesitated for 2 long days. At the height of the legendary struggle for Moscow, the Supremo actually dossed down in his greatcoat on a mattress in the subterranean halls of the metro, not unlike an omnipotent tramp. These arrangements reveal the dire lack of preparation for war. There were frequent air raids, but there were no bunkers at either the Kremlin or Kuntsevo. Stalin started to work permanently in the Kirov metro station, where he also slept. It's hard to imagine any of the other warlords living in such a way, but Stalin was accustomed to dossing down like the young revolutionary he once was. Stalin was still debating whether to leave Moscow, but the moment finally arrived, probably late on the evening of the 18th of October, when he had to decide. At the most world-shattering moment of his career, Stalin debated with generals and commissars, bodyguards and servants, and of course, he read his history. He was reading the biography of General Kutuzov, who had abandoned Moscow to Napoleon. Stalin heavily underlined the words, "Until the last minute, no one knew what Kutuzov intended to do." Back in his apartment, Valichka, in her white apron, was cheerfully serving Stalin and the magnates their dinner. When some of them seemed to lean towards evacuation, Stalin suddenly asked her, "Valentina Vasilievna, are you preparing to leave Moscow?" "Comrade Stalin," she replied, "Moscow is our mother, our home. It should be defended." "That's how Muscovites talk," Stalin told the Politburo. Stalin called Zhukov and asked him, "Are we certain we can hold Moscow? I ask you this with pain in my heart. Speak the truth, like a Bolshevik." Zhukov replied that it could be held. "It's encouraging you're so certain." Next day, Stalin summoned his magnates and generals to the little corner. "The situation is known to all of you. Should we defend Moscow?" No one answered. The silence was gloomy. Stalin waited, then said, "If you don't want to speak, I shall ask each of you to give his opinion." He started with Molotov, who stuck to his opinion. "We must defend Moscow." Everyone gave the same answer. Beria had converted to Stalin's view. "If you go, Moscow will be lost." Stalin summoned Commissar Telyagin and the commander of Moscow, NKVD General Artyemov. "What's the situation in Moscow?" "Alarming," reported Artyemov. "What do you suggest?" snapped Stalin. "A state of siege should be declared," answered Artyemov. "Correct." And Stalin ordered Malenkov to draft it. When Malenkov read out his verbose version, Stalin snatched the paper from him and briskly dictated the decree ordering the shooting on the spot of suspected offenders. Stalin brought up the divisions to defend Moscow, naming many of them from memory, then calling their commanders directly. The NKVD was unleashed onto the streets, executing deserters and even concierges who had tried to leave. The decision to stay and fight had been made. "The presence of Stalin in Moscow," said the Comintern leader, Dimitrov, "was worth a good-sized army." Stalin was refreshed by the end of the uncertainty. When a commissar phoned in from the front to discuss evacuation eastwards, Stalin interrupted him. "Find out. Do your comrades have spades?" "Yes, we've got spades. What should we do with them?" "Tell your comrades," replied Stalin calmly, "to take their spades and dig their own graves. We won't leave Moscow. They won't leave either." The panzers were still advancing on the frozen snow and threatening to encircle Moscow. Zhukov had no reserves left. Having lost 3 million of his soldiers since June, the little leather notebook in which Stalin detailed his forces was virtually empty. Like a despotic shopkeeper, assisted by his fat accountant son, Stalin jealously guarded his secret reserves, while Malenkov sat beside him, keeping tally. When Stalin asked one general what would save the capital, he replied, "Reserves." "Any idiot," snapped Stalin, "could defend the city with reserves." Stalin generously gave him 15 tanks, all they had left. Amazingly, in just a few months, the vast military resources of this endless empire had been reduced to this. In Berlin, the Reich Press Office declared that Russia was finished. But Stalin's iron husbandry of his reserves, coupled with Zhukov's brilliant and brutal fighting, was telling on the Germans. Their machines were beginning to suffer from the mud and ice, while their men were freezing and exhausted. They halted to prepare for a final push, convinced that Stalin's resources were exhausted, but there was a page in the notebook that the Germans had forgotten. Stalin's Far Eastern Army, 700,000 strong, guarded against Japan. But now Richard Zorge, the spy Stalin called a brothel keeper, reported that Japan would not attack Russia. On the 12th of October, Stalin discussed this with his Far Eastern satraps, who confirmed Tokyo's lack of hostile intentions from local intelligence. Kaganovich arranged non-stop trains that, within days and hours, rushed 400,000 fresh troops, 1,000 tanks, and 1,000 planes across the Eurasian wastes in one of the most decisive logistical miracles of the war. These secret legions began to mass behind Moscow. On the 30th of October, Stalin suddenly asked General Artiemov, "How are we going to have the military parade?" "There could be no parade," answered Artiemov. The Germans were less than 50 miles away. Molotov and Beria thought he was joking, but Stalin calmly ignored them. "A parade will be held. I'll see to it personally. If there's an air raid during the parade and there are dead and wounded, they must be quickly removed and the parade allowed to go on. A newsreel should be made and distributed throughout the country. I'll make a speech. What do you think?" "But what about the risk?" mused Molotov. "Though I admit the political response would be enormous." "So, it's decided." Just before 8 a.m. on the 7th of November, in a snowstorm and with biting winds that preserved them from German air attack, Stalin led the Politburo up the steps to the mausoleum, just like old times. Except it was earlier and everyone was extremely nervous. Budyonny, the public favorite at parades, rode out from the Spassky gate on a white stallion with his saber drawn. The tanks, including the T-34s, the outstanding machine of the war, and troops paraded in columns, U-turned at St. Basil's, then headed up Gorky Street to the front. There was a tense moment when a heavy tank stopped abruptly and turned in the wrong direction, followed by another. Since they were all fully armed, and since Stalin was watching this blunder carefully, Artiemov ordered his subordinates to investigate at once. Having caught up with the tanks, their crews were interrogated and innocently revealed that the first tank had simply received a message that another tank was in trouble. Following their training, the other tanks had gone to its aid. When Artiemov reported this on the mausoleum, the potentates were so relieved that they laughed. No one was punished. Stalin spoke shortly about the patriotic struggle of the Russia of Kutuzov and Alexander Nevsky. The motherland was in peril, but defiant. Appropriately, that very night, the Russian freeze really set in. On the 15th of November, the Germans made the last push to take Moscow and broke through. Again, Stalin asked Zhukov, could he hold Moscow? "Without doubt. But we've got to have at least 2 more armies and no fewer than 200 tanks. Stalin delivered the armies. "But for the time being, we don't have any tanks." Zhukov fought the Germans to a standstill on the 5th of December, having lost 155,000 men in 20 days. Effectively, Hitler's Blitzkrieg had failed. On the 6th of December, Stalin delivered 3 new armies to Zhukov and ordered a grand counteroffensive on the 4 nearest fronts. The next day, Japan attacked America at Pearl Harbor. Zhukov drove the Germans back 200 miles. The Battle of Moscow was Stalin's first victory, but a limited one. However, he was immediately dangerously over-optimistic, telling the visiting British Foreign Secretary, Anthony Eden, "Russians have already been in Berlin twice and will be a third time." It would take millions more dead and almost 4 years to reach Berlin. Zhukov was so exhausted that even when Stalin telephoned, his adjutants had to tell him, "Zhukov is asleep and we can't wake him." "Don't wake him up until he wakes himself," answered the Supremo benevolently. "Let him sleep."